I'm David Hatcher, EG's Head of Content, and I'm here with Pui Guan Man, our retail correspondent, and we're joined by Oliver Shah, City Editor of the Sunday Times, and most importantly this week, author of Damaged Goods, The Rise and Fall of Philip Green and the Collapse of BHS. Ollie, thank you for joining us.
Hi guys, good to be here.
How's this week been for you so far? A little bit unusual on the whirlwind tour, not the usual week, I imagine.
Yeah, still walking with my own kneecaps, which is a good starting point.
Absolutely.
Although the book doesn't come out until Thursday, so there's still time.
I'm sure the great man has an advanced copy, I would hope.
He's not seen the full thing, actually. We had loads of points we had to put to him for legals during the writing, as you'd expect, to which he replied with two words.
Which we can imagine what they are,
It was actually no comment. It was...
Well, that's quite polite.
Politer than his usual self, yeah. The fact it was done via shillings probably has something to do with that. But no, he's not seen the full thing yet, unless he's got hold of an advanced copy from a journalist or a contact, which is far from... Unbelievable.
Yes, absolutely. We're obviously coming from a property angle, and in your journey through the book, how central has property been to his rise and fall? Clearly, he's a retail mogul, but he's been engaged with the property industry throughout, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, because to me, Green has always been a real estate guy, first and foremost, actually, and then a retailer second. And if you go way back to his beginnings, the book sort of sets out how he actually grew up in a fairly affluent, leafy part of North London. His parents were pretty sort of successful middle-class business people. His mum owned a few garages, petrol stations, coin laundries. The family had a buy-to-let property portfolio, which was quite big. By the time his mum died, I think it was 60, 70 sort of houses, flats in the Croydon area.
Wow.
So the sort of family DNA was property and retail, as so often with these kind of entrepreneurial families. And when he first started out in business, Philip Green would often borrow against the family property portfolio's collateral to fund his early deals. So he bought a company called Bonanza Jeans in 1985, which was one of those kind of funny, scrappy deals that put him on the road to the big time, and really amusing stories about how he flew down to Bristol in a helicopter to buy the company from PwC, the administrator, and then couldn't fly it back at 5 a.m. because it was too loud that time of night. So he sort of caught the milk train back to London, slept on a park bench, and was sort of back in work for 9 a.m.
That's how you do a deal. Very, very impressive.
So there's lots of fun sort of, on your bike, stuff like that. And so his DNA is property to begin with. And as he rose up through the 90s, the big deal that sort of put him back on the city's map after the humiliation of Amber Day in 1992 was the 1999 breakup of Sears. Do you remember that, with mm-hmm. Adams Children's Wear and all the brands that went to Arcadia, like Dorothy Perkins and things? And the whole point of that deal was property, really, and that the market was undervaluing the property portfolio. It was only valuing the retail operations company. So he bought it very cheaply with the Barclay brothers, smashed it into pieces, sold off all the various brands, and was left with a property portfolio for free. It was worth around 300 million quid. And wow. that was the first deal that really made the city sit up and think, wow, this guy can make money, and spot undervalued assets. And
and he did very well indeed.
Absolutely. Indeed.
What do you think he's got any sort of respect from the property industry, landlords? Do you think he's considered a friend or foe of landlords? I mean, clearly he's a tough person to have been negotiating with, but then again, he's paid a fair amount of rent over the years.
Yeah, I would guess it's grudging respect. And he's a bit of a bastard, isn't he, with deal making, and a really tough guy. And I've heard so many anecdotes over the years of him, property being quite opaque as it is, and not a listed market often, and, you know, things done between agents and principals in a fairly sort of informal way. Lots of stories about him really pushing people for the lowest possible price, leveraging every relationship he has to get hold of deals. He's a landlord to many retailers, so he's tough in that way. He's also tough on landlords as a tenant. I think he understands the market both ways. And in happier times, when he and I were in the honeymoon phase of our relationship, which didn't last very long, we had an interview, and I said something like, you know, you must have your fingers in so many pies. And he said, you would not believe. And I think his personal property portfolio, which is stuff you wouldn't see because it'll be held through SPVs, mm-hmm. would be absolutely huge, kind of prime West End, prime regional towns. I imagine a lot of the wealth that he's taken out of Arcadia and BHS over the years, he will have ploughed back into real estate in the UK, because I think it's what he understands, it's what he loves.
Absolutely.
Kind of physical bricks and mortar and
And I think he still owns the Nike Town on Oxford Street, which must be worth a bob or two, as far as I know, as well, which I think is a fair chunk.
Yeah, I forget what the position is with that, because it was definitely part of Arcadia, wasn't it? And he'd he'd kept hold of that, and he'd at various times mortgaged it and taken money out of it and then paid the mortgage down a bit. So I'm not sure how much equity there is in there. But it is a prime site, and I do know that he...
Careful, Ollie, we don't want to get you sued again.
I'm battle-hardened.
Okay, good. And it seems that he reserves particular disdain for agents in particular. I don't think he had a great word to say in the excerpt that we've all read in the Sunday Times about Savills.
That's exactly right. He Green as an individual is someone who hates advisors, hates middlemen. He hates paying fees. He thinks he can do everything better himself. And there's a separate scene where he's selling BHS to Dominic Chappelle, and he sort of turns contemptuously to Chappelle's lawyers in the boardroom and says, "Why are you all here? I can effing do this deal myself." And you know, real contempt for professionals who don't put their own skin in the game, take fees for advising. And that anecdote you refer to is from... It's a few days after BHS went into administration, and he's sort of gathering all the professionals into one room in Berners Street, the Arcadia headquarters, and there's the administrators and a few lawyers, and there's a guy from Savills who does retail property, who a lot of your listeners will know, but it will remain nameless for the, you know...
For the record.
for the record. And I think Green had some previous beef with Savills around them not giving him the valuations he thought he deserved on his own portfolio. So this guy walked in, and it's important to zoom out for a minute and say, actually, at the start of meetings, Green, being the kind of guy he is, loves to beat up one person at the start of a meeting, pour encourager les autres. You know, he loves destroying someone early on, whether it's a banker, a lawyer, an advisor, just to scare everyone, so everyone sits up a bit straighter, pays attention, and knows he's in charge. A very kind of predatorial way of behaving. And so he A, had some beef with Savills, apparently over rents, and B, saw this guy walk in and thought, right, I'm going to tear him apart and sort of show everyone else who's in control.
Charming, charming. So given that, what advice would you have for somebody who was the other side of the negotiating table with Mr. Green, or Sir Philip, as we should probably call him, or maybe not anymore, as somebody who's been probably tête-à-tête with him more than anyone, or as much as anyone?
So from the people I've spoken to who've received that kind of hairdryer treatment in a room, which can be quite intimidating because he's picking on one person, really dismembering them and trying to knock down their confidence. People who have survived that and lived to tell the story have just said they stayed very calm and just poker face, didn't show any distress, took it, because he's a great poker player and he's looking for weakness. Me personally, similar thing actually. I find whenever he's on the phone ranting and raving, threatening this, that and the other, the worst thing you can do is get involved in a sort of slanging match or fighting fire with fire. And I find being sort of calm and sitting back a bit and letting him say his piece has always been my approach.
Sounds very sensible.
We've heard you can do quite a good impression of him, actually. Don't know if you'd be able to supply a sentence or two.
I was discouraged by Penguin from doing impressions, but I'll give you one recent one, which is, "We are going to end up in a horrible, horrible, messy place."
Oh, it sends chills down my spine. And talking that, I mean, have you ever felt threatened by him? I mean, there's the famous sort of throw you out the window sort of line. But have you ever truly felt threatened by him, or is it just sort of all hot air, do you think?
It's quite unusual to have that level of aggression, isn't it, coming down the phone at you? And I'm not sure how charming or not charming your property contacts are, but it's rarely that you get someone really going that hard on you. And so I think, especially to begin with, when he was still very powerful, and he obviously had a lot of contacts within the newspaper and News UK, and there's a sense that while beating you up, he knows your bosses and your bosses' bosses, and there's a sense of untouchability. That's a bit frightening, because you, to start with, you feel like there's nowhere you can go or complain to if he says these things. And actually, you realise over time that's all a mirage, and no one really liked him. It was all a sort of confidence game. And I think once I realised that what he was saying was basically bluster, it became a lot less frightening, albeit it's still quite hard not to have a kind of physical reaction when someone's, you know, screaming and shouting down the phone. But I think at one point in one of our calmer moments, I referred to his boys from South London, which he always used to kind of bandy about as, you know, something he could hold over people. And he said, "Oliver, if I really had boys from South London, they would have come for you a long time ago." I took some sliver of comfort from that.
After you, please.
Well, I mean, towards the end of the book, you know, you do, there is a sort of a note about Arcadia and you know, looking towards the future of his retail empire, so to speak, as the former sort of high street king, now looking to looking forwards to the future of Topshop. I mean, what do you think the future is for Arcadia and the group?
I think if you look out across the whole of the high street, which is something the book touches on, over the last 15 years, really, you've seen the amazing rise of companies like ASOS, Amazon, Boohoo, Misguided. I mean, we know all the big names, and there are loads of smaller ones that, you know, someone of my age wouldn't even know about because it's all sort of 17-year-old kids buying stuff. But there's...
Oh, come on, you're not that old.
Sunday Times is like dog years. It's kind of for about 60. There's been a huge rise in these very competitive, very nimble online retailers, and it's not just brands like Topshop, but House of Fraser, Debenhams, you know, the entire mid-market, all those players who are sort of taking margin just by being in a good part of the high street physically. That game's kind of coming to an end now, and I think if you look at all the pressures from rents, business rates, declining footfall, fixed costs in staff, energy bills, all those kind of things, occupying property is a really hard place to be if you aren't a specialist with a few stores. You know, anyone with a big portfolio, even John Lewis, is finding it really hard. So to answer the question, Arcadia has sort of 2,000-ish stores, I think, globally. Lots of mid-market brands that haven't been doing that well. Dorothy Perkins, Evans, Wallace, Burton, those kind of things. For years, Topshop was the engine that kept all those things ticking over and kind of covered up their mistakes. And as I understand it, and from figures I've seen, Topshop's like-for-like's been going backwards sort of double-digit rates for the last couple of years. Obviously, the kind of the city jargon, the operational gearing of that is terrible, because when sales go backwards and you have fixed costs, it really squeezes your margin. So I think it's in a very difficult place. And just in terms of the way he's managed them, BHS, obviously huge dividends and rent went offshore after he bought it, sort of over 500 million's worth. Arcadia, well over 1.3 billion's worth of dividends, rent, charges went offshore after he bought it. So these companies have had a lot of money taken out of them. Not much put in, not much in the way of retained earnings to invest in stores and, you know, tart up shops. And if you walk around top shops outside the flagship in London, which sadly I have done occasionally, it's all sort of, you know, gaffer tape on the floors, lights blinking, walls not looking very smart. And I think for the millennial customers who they're aiming at, it's not particularly a good look. And I just think it's a very difficult place. And I can't see an obvious exit for Philip Green from that group. I can't see an obvious buyer. I can't see that you could float it. There's big pension deficits. There's kind of PR issues and political issues around a sale, particularly after what happened with BHS. And I don't say it with any sort of pleasure, because there are thousands of jobs at stake there. And obviously we would all hope for a good outcome, but it's really hard to see what that is right now.
Well, one obvious outcome that's been the case for a lot of retailers recently has been CVAs, which we've all been writing about on both sides of the table. Can you see a world where Topshop, Arcadia, goes that route?
There was a very strong rumour going around about a month ago that he'd looked at it with Deloitte and CBRE. And I actually called him up and put it to him. And the response, pretty much, which I think was right, actually, was, Oliver, I can't do a CVA because I'm Philip Green, partly thanks to you. And I think the reputational thing of closing so many stores, cutting rents, laying off staff, it'll be very, very difficult for him to do. It'll be difficult to keep suppliers confident. I'm sure he's looked at it. I don't think he'll do it, personally. I might be wrong. But I just think the whole atmosphere around CVAs has got a lot more difficult as well, hasn't it, around House of Fraser, and whether these things are being used just as a device to close stores rather than as a genuine emergency sort of lever. I think since New Look went at the start of the year, the sort of political climate around CVAs has got a lot more difficult. So I think anyone would think twice now about doing a CVA. It's not the obvious silver bullet it was 6 months ago, say. And there's more of a stigma around it. And you know you're going to get more attention from the press, from potentially MPs. So it's not easy to do.
Just taking you back to the start of your expedition and saga, when do you think this sort of... Was there a moment when this became a book in your mind? When was there sort of a moment? Was it over, or was it something that sort of gradually seeped in over time, where you think, I've got to, there's so much here, I've got to get it all down?
I think it was for me always a very epic story. If you wind back to the sale in 2015, Green gave me and Dominic O'Connell, who was my boss at the time, he gave us the exclusive interview the day of the sale, and I'd been in MIPIM, so I sort of flown back a bit worse for wear that morning. Arrived in Gatwick, I think it was, and had a text from Dominic saying that we've got this interview at 3 p.m. You need to be in the BHS headquarters on Marylebone Road then.
And so fix up, look sharp.
So I sort of legged it across town, and I hadn't been to the BHS building because obviously in latter years Philip Green always operated out of the Arcadia building on Berners Street, but this was symbolically being done in the BHS building, and we sort of waited a few minutes, and then the doors to the boardroom swung open and Green was there, sort of hair slicked back, still the emperor at that point, still very, very powerful, and was like, "The boys," and welcomed us in. And that boardroom was like a monument to the past, and it was covered in cuttings on one wall, you know, Green is go for the high street, all this kind of stuff, Arcadia's place in Green's dream, loads of cuts from the Sun and the Sunday Times and the Telegraph. There were models of his jet and his planes and stuff, and black leather sofas, and then walls, an entire sort of cupboard full of bindings of other press cuts. And you could see how important the press had been to him over the years, and you could see that entire legacy of, you know, being built up as king of the high street. And it just struck me then as a real moment in time. It was a portrait of a tycoon at a turning point, and we didn't then know how bad it would go, but I had the sense that it was, you know, a turning point for him and a turning point in his story. And the interview meandered around, and Green was very good at avoiding answering questions about who had bought BHS and who Retail Acquisitions the buyer was. And I remember asking him, "What does it mean for your reputation if it goes bust under the new owners?" And the atmosphere changed immediately. All the bonhomie evaporated straight away, and he sort of jabbed a finger at me and said, "If I give you my effing plane and you tell me you're a great effing driver and you crash it into the first effing mountain, is that my fault?" And which can't have inspired confidence among the staff.
No,
absolutely not. Who read that? Because, I mean, blimey, you could just see he was gearing up to say it's not my fault straight away. And yeah. I think from that moment on, I mean, I always have been quite sort of anal about keeping notes and, you know, dating everything and keeping all my shorthand.
Sure.
So I sort of didn't really see it being a book until I think the whole scandal really burst out into the open in sort of spring 2016 when it went into administration. And I think because it took a long time to really reach public consciousness. It was us hammering away. The Independent wrote a few things as well. Private Eye wrote a few things, but it was sort of not really mainstream until BHS actually went into administration, and then the Daily Mail jumped all over it, the Guardian jumped all over it, and it became a story people could understand then because of all the job losses and the store closures. And I think that at that point I realised how big it was, because I sort of didn't really understand how big it was going to be until then.
What have you found the hardest thing about writing a book? You know, clearly you're an extremely senior journalist, you know, writing the Sunday Times week in, week out, as well as editing. But it's your first book, right?
Yeah, first book.
How different has that process been, and how difficult was the journey of just simply writing a tome like this?
Yeah, I suppose there are sort of two answers to that. One is simply the practical level, not being in a newsroom and being in your spare room for 3 months. Is more difficult than you think. It's great for a week because you get peace and quiet, and you haven't got a phone ringing the whole time, and you can focus on one thing, and you're there. I sort of tried to start work about 8. I tried to sort of discipline myself, and I tried to work through until about 8 and then take a break then, or try and go to the gym or something, which often didn't happen. But it's amazing how exhausted you get just sitting in one place, not moving around. And it's also, I don't know about you, but I think we're all in this business because we enjoy meeting people and sort of finding contacts and finding stories and
variety, I suppose,
and variety and the just the thrill of newness, and it's kind of thing, the sense of things happening around you. I really started to miss that after about a month, and you start to go a bit stir crazy, and you wonder if the world's forgotten you, and if everything's moved on, and the ground sort of swallows you up, and you sort of see stories happening you want to get involved with.
I'm sure.
It can be a bit frustrating sort of being on the sidelines, and you have contacts calling up saying, "Have you left? What's going on?" So on a practical level, that was quite hard, and I was really glad to come back at the start of January. It was great to just get back into it, and a load of news flow. And I think the other sort of slightly more abstract thing was just writing about my own profession and my own time at the Sunday Times. It's sort of certain moments you think, should I write about the inside of a newsroom? Is that breaking some kind of code of omerta? And hopefully I sort of trod the line between not going too far there while giving readers a sense of how a newsroom works and how those kind of conflicts between source and story emerge. And I mean, things like describing how the inside of the Whopping building used to look at the Sunday Times. It was not a pretty place to work. And
so no negative feedback from colleagues thus far?
Not that they said to me.
I'm sure. I'm fairly so. Do you feel that you've got a sort of inseparable bond with him sort of nowadays? I mean, it's sort of, you get a sense that he has a sort of bizarre affection for this nemesis that has been created.
Yeah, I'm not sure affection is the word he'd use. It's well disguised under layers of rage. I think the phrase I used the other day was sort of mutual Stockholm syndrome. You weirdly get to know someone quite well when you're ringing them at all times, day and night, to put stories to them and fight fights with them. You sort of speak to them at home, speak to them at work, speak to them, in his case, on the yacht. And sort of in recent months, it's become less overtly antagonistic, because I think there's only so much anger you can have while still answering the phone. And during the course of writing the book, he would ring up occasionally, and he would often sort of start off saying, you know, you're effing sick in the head or something. And as long as you sort of play along and say, oh, why?
he liked a bit of the game along the way. Yeah, he likes to engage.
He likes bantering with journalists. He's quite a sort of journalistic guy in his own way. I mean, he loves information. He's someone who doesn't really use the internet, doesn't really use spreadsheets, doesn't really use computers. It's all about sort of gut feel and what he knows and having an edge. And I think he's always done deals on that basis by talking to people. So he enjoys speaking to journalists, dealing with them. It comes naturally to him. And I'd say sort of after the initial aggression of phone calls, it'll then end up rambling around, you know, President's Club, Me Too, broader industry themes, house trading. Occasionally he'll put Chloe on the phone, sort of tell me to stop being an arsehole, those kind of things.
And that must have been very odd.
It's a bit surreal, yeah.
You become a bit in the room.
a little bit, yeah. I mean, he did get very, very angry just before the serialisation came out, because I think you could see the sort of tenor of the book, and you could see where it's going, and that's the most angry I've heard him for a while. But
well, if he doesn't get it through the title Damaged Goods, you're not really going to get it, are you? I think it sort of sums it up.
Yeah, he wasn't keen on that.
Well, Ollie, so the book is out this Thursday, available from all good retailers and Amazon, I presume.
Yeah, Amazon. Slight irony there, I guess, with the whole sort of high street thing. But it's been selling well on Amazon, and it's going to be Smiths and Waterstones and the usual outlets. And I just really hope that it sort of reaches an audience. I mean, I hope it reaches the business audience and retail property guys, because there's lots of stuff in there they'll recognise. But I also hope it reaches an audience beyond that, because it is a story not just of business and changing market conditions and pensions and that kind of stuff. But it's a story of ego and ambition, and it's an epic story of someone with a lot of talent, and a very sad story in some ways, of someone with a lot of talent and charm who could have used it differently but always wanted that bit more for himself, always wouldn't leave a bit on the table for someone else, always had to be a bit cleverer than everyone else, always had to win, always had to squeeze the extra bit of juice out of every deal, and just pushed it too far. And I mean, if he'd sold BHS or Arcadia 10 years ago and become an angel investor in tech or something, he would be fated as an absolute hero, and he would still have his reputation and still be able to walk down the street without bodyguards and those kind of things. But it's a story of someone who almost had it all, and just through a bit of greed or a bit of ego, just pushed it a bit too far and went over the edge. And so it's a story that I hope reaches a broader audience.
I'm sure it will, and lots of lessons for us all to learn there. Ollie, thanks ever so much for joining us, and good luck with the rest of the book tour.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers.